Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This week's episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading full-service ASC regulatory compliance consulting firms, and the Regulatory Compliance series of books for ASCs by John Gailey and published by Eden Group Development. Welcome to episode 13 of the ASC podcast with John Gailey for March 26, 2018, recording from our studio here in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. I'm here with Jenna Alvarez, also a Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and John Gailey, one of the nation's leading ASC experts in the industry. He is the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, one of the most sought-after speakers about ASC financial and regulatory issues. He's an ASC developer and administrator, and now the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading ASC financial regulatory oversight firms. Welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
So I guess the biggest news this week for us was the change of our name. John, you made that decision on Monday, and things happened very fast after that. Can you tell our listeners what happened and why you changed the name?
Sure. Well, there was actually two reasons. First, I had been, and I think all of us on the podcast have been increasingly concerned that our name was going to limit us to the items that we could discuss that were within the term compliance, and that indeed people might be tuning out because we were always referring to compliance. Over the month and a half since we launched, we have realized that we really want to expand into all aspects of ambulatory surgery center management. Then everything came together on Monday when it was brought to our attention that our podcast website name is very similar to a consulting firm, and we decided to just change the name right then and there. It wasn't as difficult as I thought it was going to be. It's actually quite simple, but I know it is going to cause some confusion out there.
Well, I think it was a good move. We really have so much to talk about, and to try to fit it into the definition of compliance-related wasn't always easy.
And also, the website address is a lot shorter and easier to say. So make sure you go over to our new website, ascpodcast.com, to see our new website, which, by the way, is still under construction.
Yes, I actually fixed quite a number of things in the last 24 hours, but I still don't have all the links up yet to all the old podcasts. But keep with me. We'll be getting it done. The amazing thing is that we actually thought we were going to see a temporary decrease in the listeners with the name change. Interestingly, guys, this is very good news. Our listenership is actually up 50% over last week, and the listenership has tripled in the last 3 weeks. So clearly the word is getting around, and really we do all want to thank all of our listeners for their support, and for the obviously they're out there telling all their friends about us.
So this week we've added a new section to our podcast. We're going to start including a discussion of upcoming events in the ASC industry. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com. So our first event we're going to discuss, which I believe we've discussed a couple times on our podcast already.
And we will keep discussing until the event.
Is ASCA 2018. It is April 11th through 14th in Boston, Massachusetts at the Heinz Convention Center. And John is actually going to be doing a speech there.
Yes, I'm actually doing three speeches. One is on, one will be the CASC review course. I speak on the finance section. I'll be doing a section on finance and a section on regulatory related to surveys and being prepared for surveys.
So if anyone's interested out there, the website is www.ascassociation.com. Our next event we wanted to discuss was the New York State Association of ASCs. The event is May 17th and 18th. John, I think you have more information on that.
Yes, I'm actually on the planning committee for it. The website has very generic information. You might have to visit it a couple times before everything's up there. But it is at www.nysaasc.org. The event's going to be May 17th and 18th at the Desmond in Albany.
The next event is the New Jersey Ambulatory Surgery Association. It's their 8th annual Ambulatory Surgery Conference, June 12th through 13th. John?
Yeah, that's going to be at the Wilshire Grand Hotel, 350 Pleasant Valley Way. And to see their information, go to njaasc.org.
So in addition to the upcoming conferences, there's also a couple of the credentialing exams coming up. So first, we're going to talk about the new CAPE credential. This is going to be the first time the CAPE exam is offered. It's going to be offered October 1st through 31st of 2018. It's a computer-based exam that will be offered at testing centers. The application can be submitted August 1st through 31st. And John, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the CASC, since I know you're intimately involved in getting that.
Sure. And actually, before we finish with the CAPE, if you want more information about CAPE, go to www.aboutcaipe.org. And for the CASC credential, there's a pencil and paper exam being administered on April 14th at the Heinz Convention Center as part of ASCA 2018. It is too late, unfortunately, to register for that exam, but don't forget to go there if you already registered. The next exam, electronic one, or the one done at a testing center, will be July 1st through July 31st, 2018, and the electronic application must be submitted between May 1st and May 31st. The last exam for the year for CASC will be administered October 1st to the 31st at a testing center, and that electronic application must be submitted between August 1st and the 31st, 2018. To get more information about the CASC exam, go to www.aboutcasc.org.
Thanks, John. So as part of the news today, I want to talk about the bear huggers, the patient warming devices or heated air blankets that a lot of people that are listening probably are using. According to an October 30th, 2017 Outpatient Surgery magazine, at that time in October, there were over 4,000 lawsuits being brought claiming that the bear huggers had contributed to surgical site infections. The problem is this research was based on model analysis research that actually was published in the International Journal for Numerical Methods in Biomedical Engineering. But these studies were all based on simulation and theory that the bear huggers change the way the air flows in the room and could potentially lead to a higher infection risk. But none of these lawsuits have come to any type of judgment. And right now, the FDA is definitely recommending that you continue using the bear huggers for thermoregulation. And they've actually sent out a letter at the end of last year to providers just emphasizing that their use has resulted in reduced bleeding and lower risk of infection. So they do plan to continue monitoring this to make sure that this is the best recommendation, and we'll let you know if there's any updates in the future. And on this note, there has been a recent recall by 3M of approximately 33,000 cases of the bear huggers due to a flaw that could keep them from fully inflating. These are the full access underbody warming blanket models 63500 and 63700. Lot numbers R10359 through R10366. So as we mentioned before, with our new name, we'll be broadening our scope and bringing you even more news from the ASC industry. On this note, there is some concern with a new policy guideline from Anthem Insurance regarding cataract surgery. John, can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this is actually part of an ongoing concern that we've had, that some of the insurance companies, and it looks like Anthem is taking a lead in this, is looking at their policy with regard to covering monitored anesthesia care for, or general anesthesia for cataract patients. And they're basically created a new policy that says that they're only going to cover this for certain categories of patients, such as children under the age of 18, individuals who are unable to cooperate or communicate, such as individuals with dementia or agitation or some type of a movement disorder, and individuals who are unable to lie flat for extended periods of time, or individuals that have failed in the past with other types of anesthesia, or there's an anticipation that the procedure will be prolonged or complex, and that they're considering not medically necessary the administration of MAC and general anesthesia if none of those criteria are met. Our concern here is that it is starting to move away from the standard of care. I used to run two eye surgery centers over my lifetime here, and certainly moving away from monitored anesthesia care, I think, is not in the best interest of the majority of patients. So we're going to keep a very close eye on this and see where this is heading. And certainly it's time for the doctors to speak up and give their impressions or their concerns about this if they believe that monitored anesthesia care, or in some cases, general anesthesia care is necessary.
Okay, and in infection news, researchers from the University of Iowa found that the rate of surgical site infection increased 2% for every 5-degree increase in average monthly temperature, with 26.5% more surgery site infections in the peak month of August as opposed to January. The risk is pretty small, and of course, we can't control the weather. I think if we could, it would be 70 degrees today in Rochester instead of 24 degrees, but... we can at least just be aware of this and, you know, just be more aware of follow-up and discharge instructions for your patients in those really hot and steamy months. Another thing to talk about is the fentanyl shortage. I know this is causing a lot of problems for some people, and just recommend, you know, really keeping up to date on the availability, planning ahead, and being aware of the risk of errors when you're changing vial sizes or concentrations or even substituting different drugs. Jenna, do you have any thoughts about that? I know as a nurse when I worked in the hospital, you know, we just got used to certain concentrations, and it was always a concern if we had to change a type of drug or change the way that we received the drug as we were measuring out our doses.
Well, I think sometimes you do get kind of comfortable working with the drugs that you are used to, and it kind of reminds you that every time you need to use those 7 rites of medication administration. So looking at that bottle every time, making sure that you are drawing up the correct drug, the correct amount, and having another nurse verify that you've done your correct calculations if you're not sure.
Especially with high alert drugs, look like, sound like drugs, all those drugs that we need to be very carefully monitoring.
Yeah, and this year I know that HHC has even joined Joint Commission in making sure that every surgery center that is accredited by them has a high alert list. That's not something they enforced before. Before it was just look-alike, sound-alike drugs that everyone needed to have a list of and have a plan for how to address those. Now they are really focusing in on high alert drugs as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't know that we've mentioned that yet, but yeah, if you are HHC accredited, you probably haven't thought too much about high alert drugs in the past. So get those high alert drug stickers. Talk to your pharmacy consultant if you have one, and make sure you've got a good list, a solid list there, and that everybody knows what to do with a high alert drug. Okay, I think that's it for this section. Why don't we take a short break, and we'll be back with our, shall we say, a deep dive into infection control.
John, we're all very excited to have a new advertiser this week, Synergy Environmental Services from California, covering Northern and Southern California. John, can you tell us more?
Absolutely. So we know selecting a competent cleaning company that knows the challenges of cleaning an ambulatory surgery center is no easy task, as all of us that have worked in the industry knows. So when considering the environmental aspects of infection control, it is critical that an organization's that outsource their cleaning services engage companies that know all about the ASC industry, know the requirements for properly cleaning an operating suite, and provide the appropriate OSHA training requirements for their staff. If your center is located in California, please talk to our friends at Synergy Environmental Services in California. Follow the link on our website for this week's podcast or call Zach at 916-812-2698. That's Zach at 916-812-2698. So this week we're going to do a very deep discussion into infection control. So infection control has always been a bit of an issue in ambulatory surgery centers, but in about 2008, that's when some major changes occurred to the rules and regulations, the conditions for coverage, basically, for ambulatory surgery centers. And that's when new regulations were put into place to have actually an appointed infection control preventionist. The reason for the increase in the surveillance of infection control was a series of events that occurred in various parts of the country where infections in surgery centers rose to a much higher level than was acceptable to the government. So as always, when the government sees that type of issue, they try to find a regulatory solution. To that end, they created Section 41651 of the Conditions for Coverage, Infection Control. And that section reads that an ASC must maintain an infection control program that seeks to minimize infections and communicable diseases. And this includes three parts. One is a sanitary environment. The ASC must provide a functional and sanitary environment for the provision of surgical services by adhering to professionally acceptable standards of practice. Second, it must have an actual infection control program, written program. The ASC must maintain an ongoing program designed to prevent, control, and investigate infections and communicable diseases. In addition, that infection control and prevention program must include documentation that the ASC has considered, selected, and implemented nationally recognized infection control guidelines, and that the infection control program has to be under the direction of a designated and qualified professional who has training in infection control, and that the program must be an integral part of the ASC's quality assessment and performance improvement program, which we what we call QAPI, and the organization is responsible for providing a plan of action for preventing, identifying, and managing infections and communicable diseases, and for immediately implementing corrective and preventative measures that result in improvement. So I think it's really important to remember that you should also be reading the interpretive guidelines, especially the infection control preventist, who really needs to become intimately familiar with the details of the infection prevention section of the interpretive guidelines, which are quite detailed. Jenna, do you want to start off by talking about the reviewing of infections?
Sure. So there's three main aspects of the infection control program. The first is your review of infections. So this includes your monthly survey sent out to the physicians with a list of every procedure they've performed that month. This should be sent out 30 days after the end of the month in order to make sure that all possible infections are captured by the survey. And it also includes letting your patients know in their discharge instructions and during their post-op phone call that if they see any signs of infection, they need to call their doctor and notify them.
I guess we should also point out at this point that once you do find out about an infection, you need to do a thorough investigation of it. There's a lot of different forms up on Ask a Connect, for example, how to thoroughly investigate that infection. But this is a time-consuming procedure, and I think infection preventists, I know as part of their training, they'll get extensive education on what to do, how to investigate it. But just briefly, the types of things you're going to be looking into is you're going to try to find any commonalities with infections if you have multiple infections. Look into the individuals that were there on the day that the patient got that infection to find out if there any of them were sick or whether any of them later were found out to have a communicable disease. Look at all the sterilization records for the equipment and supplies used during that day. Look at the cleaning records for the facility to see if there were any breaches during that day. So you really want
looking
to investigate.
Looking at your logs.
Looking at the logs, correct. So you want to really do a very thorough investigation, and all of that should be documented for every infection that you have.
The next important aspect of the infection control program is your surveillance. This includes your hand hygiene surveillance, your sharp safety surveillance, and your environmental rounds. Sue, why don't you start us off with hand hygiene surveillance?
So the new Joint Commission guidelines are far more stringent for hand hygiene. You can be cited for even one incident of failure to follow correct hand hygiene guidelines. So now is a good time to talk to staff about the importance of proper hand hygiene. It really is the first line of defense against infection. And although I know we all know that, it is important to remember that in your busy moments that can't be overlooked. Also think about how you are monitoring this in your own facility. Often we get used to other staff keeping an eye on us or the infection specialist. And when we know who's watching us, sometimes this can lead to inaccurate results in your monitoring. Jenna, you had a good hand hygiene story.
Yeah, so when I used to work in a hospital, my supervisor used to be the delegated person to do hand hygiene surveillance down on the PACU. We worked night shift, and whenever she would go down at 2 o'clock in the morning, there would only be maybe two or three people actually there. And after a couple months, they kind of had caught on that that's what she was there for each month. So she would walk in and say, "Hi guys, how's it going?" Or, you know, try to sneak in. And as soon as they saw her, it was, "Oh, hi, Rendy." And then, you know, a very exaggerated hand washing motion. So, you know, they knew that that was what she was there for, and you're not going to get an accurate result. I kind of question when we go into our clients' centers and I see 100% down the line for hand hygiene, because humans make mistakes. And even though you might be really good about hand hygiene, there are going to be times when you miss it. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that you want to be honest about, because when a surveyor comes in and looks at your hand hygiene and it's always 100%, and then they take a look around and one person doesn't do hand hygiene, kind of going to look bad.
Well, precisely. I mean, a surveyor looks and sees 100% hand hygiene and then immediately sees something the first time they walk in, you're going to be in trouble, because it means that they're going to basically observe that your hand hygiene surveillance program is not working at all. So that's a pretty serious situation. By the way, I believe the national statistic is somewhere between 60 and 70% hand hygiene compliance. So if you're finding numbers in that range, you're probably normal. If you're above that, then you're great. If you're 100%, nobody will believe you're there. Now, Jenna, yesterday you and I were at doing a site visit, and one of the people we met was talking about how she does various types of surveillance, including hand hygiene. And what she said is she would go into a room and she would actually pretend to be talking to the doctor, right? Or she would be talking to the doctor. And then while she was there, she would be monitoring things like hand hygiene, sharp surveillance, sharp safety, and things like that, which she found was a very effective way of doing it. They didn't really know that they were being monitored. They thought that that she was there for some other purpose. I thought that was probably a pretty good way of doing this. One thing I'd also note is that hanging a sign for patients saying, hey, did you observe your provider performing appropriate hand hygiene before? Really, first of all, it's good, you know, for the patients to be doing some of that monitoring, but I think it's good for the employees also to know that we're telling the patients to watch out for it. So I think
you're empowering the patient to take an active part in their care.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Of course, as a nurse, that's what you're going to exactly say. So that's exactly, that's what we want to hear.
Another good idea that I actually heard at the last ASCA conference was having random employees in your facility be the person responsible for doing the surveillance. One of the infection preventionists talked about handing out little cards to a different employee each month, which goes through all of the aspects of proper hand hygiene, and having them look for all those aspects among their other employees to both empower them to speak up about hand hygiene, but also to make sure that they're reviewing the proper hand hygiene aspects, because I think we get somewhat complacent in the fact that we are doing hand hygiene properly, but maybe we aren't getting every part of our hand properly cleaned.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll be putting up a link on our website to some tools and signs that you can post in your facility to help remind everybody. And I think even if you have signs already posted, it's always a good idea to switch things up. And I think when we see a sign every day as we're going into work, we sort of ignore it. We don't even see it anymore. So just kind of switching things to bring new information and just to keep it forefront in everybody's mind.
The next surveillance we're going to talk about is our sharp safety surveillance and using an ongoing monitoring tool to surveil this at least every month.
Correct. So when it comes to sharp safety, there's a couple tools that are out there that are kind of nice. I think sharp safety surveillance often can be just as simple as what we used to call an MBA school, management by walking around. In other words, a good nurse manager, a good infection control supervisor or preventionist is going to be walking around just observing on a regular basis all of these things and then periodically writing these things down and including as part of our infection control report. The best way to make sure that all of these things are being done is to monitor and intervene immediately when things are noted that are not appropriate.
Lastly is environmental rounds and the surveillance that is done on an ongoing basis of surveilling the center and make sure that you have constant monitoring of the cleanliness of your facility.
Yeah, so this is probably one of the toughest areas, I think. Really, you should have daily, weekly, monthly checks of the environment, the cleanliness. It's often the most challenging area in the average surgery center. You have to keep an eye out for the inevitable dust that is generated in an operating room. During a survey, often I find, problems with this. About 2 months ago, I was doing a survey, and I was just going through the operating room. It was in between procedures, but there was a shelf with a cover on top of it. And I just put my finger on the top of this this cover at the very top, thinking, you know, well, let's see if there's any dust. Well, not only did I disturb dust, I actually created a dust cloud. It actually contaminated the area.
Cringing a little bit right now.
Exactly. I was cringing, and I said, you know, do not start another procedure until you clean all of this dust out of here. And they got the point very quickly. So before I became a consultant, I ran two surgery centers in Rochester, New York. And one of the biggest challenges I had in running those centers was hiring outside cleaners. And very frequently, I was finding myself having to fire a cleaning company because they just could not learn to clean an ambulatory surgery or surgical suite properly. So my biggest suggestion here is that you make sure you hire a company that has healthcare cleaning experience. Don't even bother with a non-healthcare firm. If your surgery center is located in a office building that doesn't have other healthcare occupancies in there, certainly do not hire the company that they're using to clean the offices. I'm not sure how they would actually get the expertise needed to be able to clean a surgical suite. Make sure that the organization that you hire it has appropriate OSHA and OSHA bloodborne pathogen training. And it's highly desirable to hire a firm with specific training in ambulatory surgery centers, not just healthcare occupancies, such as our friends over at Synergy Environmental Services in California. Whoever you hire, though, you need to keep up with the cleaning. Create a specific cleaning schedule for each room in the facility. Maintain a log of issues that you have with the cleaners and make sure that they read it on a regular basis. Meet regularly with the supervisor and go through the facility to identify issues that you've seen in the past. And also talk about changes that are occurring with the organization and pointing out things that they need to spend more time cleaning that they might not have thought about in the past. I also surprise the cleaners every once in a while by coming in and catching them when they're doing cleaning. Or one thing I used to do is have cameras monitoring critical areas in the organization just to make sure that they are indeed cleaning. You'd be surprised at what you find. We know one center recently came in during the off hours when the cleaners actually had their children with them in the center, and they were not wearing protective clothing in the surgical suite. So just to wrap up in this area, environmental services is a very critical aspect of infection control. Make sure you hire the best. Consider bringing the service in-house if you find that you just can't hire cleaners that are doing it, that can do a good job. I've actually done that in the past where I've been able to hire full-time cleaners that work for me during the day, and they just had a regular schedule of going through the place and cleaning while we were there on site. And I found that very effective. I don't think it's going to work in many of your organizations, though.
The third important aspect of the infection control program is the ongoing education. The infection control program should be reviewed annually with your staff as part of the mandatory annual education, as well as the mandatory education during the orientation process. This education should be specific to your organization.
Yeah, well, for example, Jenna, just this last week, we were talking to somebody who mentioned that they don't need to do education, annual education for infection control because they are certified by New York State in infection prevention. And when we queried them what they were talking about, they were saying, well, every 3 years, just before we get licensed, we go through this infection control course, an online course that they do. And they felt that that was all they needed in order to be competent in infection control. So you and I both pointed out to them two problems with that. First of all, it was every 3 years. Second, it was not specific to the organization. And it didn't go into the details of the infection control program in that organization.
And another important thing is doing ongoing in-services with your staff, especially when you discover issues with infection prevention issues. So if you see something like poor hand hygiene, bad sharp safety, or, you know, even your sterile technique, whatever it might be, if you see something, that is a good topic to review with staff as an in-service or an educational program.
So recently, one of our clients had a problem where the linen company showed them that two syringes had been left in the linen. and went back to the linen company like that, which fortunately did not harm anybody, but, and it was caught before anybody got stuck with it. But they brought it to our attention. The administration immediately came to us and said, can you develop an in-service program specifically to this task? And that's exactly what we did, is we developed one that really talked about the dangers of this and gave examples of what to do and how to make sure that, you know, this type of a problem never happens again. So it's really smart for you to use your surveillance program to identify issues and then show a direct correlation between what you've identified and the programs that you've developed, educational programs you've developed to resolve those.
Okay, so John, let's next talk about what an infection control preventionist is.
So in an ASC, you must designate in writing an infection control preventionist. So the governing body has to appoint an infection control preventionist. And CMS identifies this as a qualified licensed healthcare professional. That means it has to be a licensed individual, such as a doctor or a nurse. And this person needs to lead the facility's infection control program. The ambulatory surgery center must determine that this individual has had training in the principles and methods of infection control. They don't need to be certified, but they do need to have evidence of training and have evidence specifically in ambulatory surgery center infection control. So long as that there is a documentation that the individual has training, that qualifies the individual to be to lead an infection control program. They also must maintain their qualifications through ongoing education and training, and surveyors will be looking for that as part of the survey. And this can be demonstrated by participation in infection control courses, either in person or online, or attendance at local or national meetings organized by recognized professional societies. Let's talk a little bit about the different options for training an infection control preventionist. AORN has a course called the Ambulatory Infection Prevention Course. It's available online at AORN.org. It costs $205 if you're a member as of the date of this podcast, and $275 if you're a non-member. At this time, it's the most cost-effective and quickest way to get basic education in ASC infection prevention oversight. We've put a lot of people over the years through this. It's our go-to course if we pick up a new client and we find out that they don't have any evidence that the infection control preventionist has been trained specifically in this, and they can do this literally in one day. APIC has long been training infection control preventionists also. Now they have a new program. It's a four-day intensive course. It's called Ambulatory Surgery Center Intensives. The next course is going to be May 14th through the 17th, 2018 in Atlanta, Georgia. The course cost is $1,150 if you're a member, or $1,300 if you're a non-member, plus, of course, travel and hotel. This is a novice level 4-day course, and it provides an intensive training experience for healthcare professionals providing infection prevention oversight. And it is specific to surgery centers, pain clinics, endoscopy centers, and other ambulatory care practice settings. This is a highly interactive course, very intensive. The problem with it, of course, is it's the enrollment is limited. You're going to have to travel to do this, and it's very difficult for many of our surgery centers, both from a cost standpoint and from just that amount of time being away from the center. The third option, relatively new, ASC Association has always been doing infection control training, but recently it's ratcheted this up to a new level. We kicked this off in the winter seminars just in January, and now ASCA 2018 has 2 full days of ASC-specific infection control training. And this is the best option if you're looking into certification, as we're going to talk about in the next section, or if you're thinking of going to ASCA 2018 anyway. So definitely look into that. If you are the infection control and preventionist in your organization, or consider bringing your preventionist with you. As we noted, certification is not necessary. The most notable certification program right now is probably the CIC program developed by APIC. But this is really only oriented towards hospitals. And by the way, you can be a CIC without actually being a healthcare provider. So a CIC can be a microbiologist, for example. But an infection control preventionist in a surgery center has to be a provider. We found over the years that the CIC doesn't really help surgery centers in general, because it has such a big focus on hospital-based areas. And that's the reason why the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification and the ASC Association developed the CAPE credential, the new Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist credential. The credential is part of the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification, better known as BASC. I am actually the president of BASC right now, and at least until the end of June when my term runs out. And our board has been very much involved in overseeing the development of this new credential. We're very excited about the credential and for the future of infection prevention oversight with this credential in existence. We've been working on this credential for more than a year, and we've been working with one of the better-known professional testing companies known as AMP, who actually has a heavy concentration in professional testing of healthcare professionals. And they've helped us. They also helped us to develop the CASC exam. It has been a long process. It involves identifying the body of knowledge and reviewing the requirements of a preventionist, creating test questions, testing those questions, rewriting the questions, and assuring that the test is really scientifically based. We expect, or we are promised, that that test will be done by October, since our first exam will be in October. And I think anybody that is serious about infection prevention programs in ambulatory surgery center needs to look into this. I think just as important as the credential is the dedication now that the ASC Association has to ongoing ASC-specific infection prevention. And I know that that's going to be a regular part of all of our ASCA conferences, the annual conferences that we hold.
So just a reminder, ongoing training is critical both for staff and your infection preventionist. So once you do one of these courses or get your certification, you're not done. You need to keep going constantly, looking for more information, keeping up to date with the science that is coming out in the journals. AORN, APIC, there's a lot of great resources out there for continuing education.
Absolutely. And joining APIC is a great way of keeping really up to date. They send out daily emails. This is Saturday when we're recording this podcast. I've already received two emails from them. I haven't had a chance to read them, but they do provide a lot of good information about infection prevention. So definitely consider joining APIC if for no other reason, but to get those ongoing, that ongoing information. I know Sue uses those as part of her preparation for the news section every week.
And they have a specific, just like Ask a Connect, they have a specific conversation section for ambulatory care where people can ask questions about issues going on in their centers.
Right. And Jenna, that actually brings up a very important point here about the ambulatory surgery industry in general, is that I don't want anyone to ever feel like they're without peers to talk to. You know, if you're a member of the ASC Association, you have Ask Connect. If you're a member of APIC, you have that option. And of course, if you're a listener of this podcast, you have comments at ASCpodcast.com. Please ask your questions here. We'd be glad to put them on the air, or if we can answer them through email, we'd be glad to do that also.
And you have a special offer for our listeners this week.
Yes, indeed we do. So as a special offer for all of our listeners on this podcast, we're offering a significant discount on my book, The Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers. This book, as hopefully everyone knows by now, is the leading book in the industry for preparing for a CMS survey. Has a lot of information about what the regulations are, the interpretive guidelines, and really has a nice index to be able to find this information quickly. I find it's particularly helpful for those difficult questions we sometimes get from the physicians when they say, okay, show me the regulation. And they can pull this book out and go right to that section very quickly. So in order to take advantage of this deal, go to the ASCpodcast.com website, which is ASCpodcast.com. And follow the link for this week's episode. You will see a link to purchase the book.
And how long is this offer available?
You can purchase this book at this discount through April 30th.
Thanks, John. So please head over to our website, ASCpodcast.com, to take advantage of this great offer. podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. Our other sponsor today is Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including The Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage, and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ASCpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ASCpodcast.com.